You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff, the podcast that celebrates those who live, love, and breathe rock and roll. From the incredible groupies, girlfriends, and wives who went after what and who they wanted, to the journalists, photographers, and other behind-the-scenes characters who play such an important part in rock and roll history. We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Electrified Porcupine,
bringing you the best in collectibles, movies, music, wrestling, gaming, and more. Check it out at electrifiedporcupine.com. Hey everyone, we're so excited to present this episode to you this week, and we've been excited about it for a few weeks. So what you're going to hear today is Lynx and my interview with Maureen Van Zandt. Now, if the Maureen Van Zandt name sounds familiar to you, it could be for a number of reasons. Maybe you've seen her on The Sopranos, or maybe it's the Van Zandt name that gets you. And yes, it's that very one. She has been married to Steven Van Zandt for over 36 years. Yes, Lynx is going, yes. And there's not a whole lot about her on the internet, but we had a fabulous conversation about her, and she really opened up, and we had a lot of fun, and we got to learn a lot about her.
Yeah, and she's such a joy. It was such a lovely conversation. Can't wait to do it again. Definitely want to have Maureen back on. There are so many stories that she told us and so many more. You can tell she's just got tons of them stored away. So that's amazing. And yeah, it was just incredible to hear her talk and to get to know a little more about her. She's an incredible woman. She not only from The Sopranos, but she's been acting and dancing since she was a kid. And she told us about producing and how she's created her own company. And not only that, we have much more in common. She's also a podcaster now, and we talk about so much, and it's so exciting. Thank you, Maureen.
Thank you so much, Maureen. We hope that you really like this interview. We learned a lot of things that we were really surprised to find out about. We won't spoil it for you, but little things like who she used to hang out with back in New York when she was just a young teenager, how she came to meet Steven, and all of the wonderful organizations that they're a part of. And I think, you know, one of the most exciting things we have to talk about was this idea of women uplifting women and empowering one another to just go farther and and pursue the life of your dreams. So without further ado, here it is, our interview with Maureen Van Zandt.
Thank you so much for doing this with us. We've been so excited and so like looking forward to this. Maureen, you've had such an incredible life and career, and you know, we just want to take it all the way back and go to the beginning. And Shanti, how about you kick it off?
I'm going to kick it off. What was little Maureen like? Were the arts always prominent in your home?
Little Maureen was a very difficult little girl. they were not that prominent in my home. My parents were not all that big on the arts, but my grandfather used to take me to Broadway shows when I was very little, and I remember going to see West Side Story when I was 7, and that made a huge impression on me. I was already in dance school, and when I saw that, I thought, that's it. That's what I want to do. And so I then became more serious about ballet and dancing in general, and that was kind of it. He would take me to see shows, and I just was completely in love with all that stuff, and became a serious ballet student because I'm not a singer. You know, I've been in a couple of shows where I had to sing, but it's not really anything you want to hear on my own. Maybe in a group I can get away with it. But yeah, so I think at first I wanted to be on Broadway, and then I realized I did not have the triple threat thing going, just dancing and maybe acting, but definitely not singing. So yeah, that's kind of how it started. And I studied ballet for many, many years. I joined a ballet company when I was 17. I did the Broadway show Hair when
Amazing.
I was about 18. I took time off from ballet because it was, it was very, very restrictive, not artistically, but just in the way you have to live. And it kind of was really getting to me, the dieting, and I had lost a lot of weight and got really sick, and I just decided to take some time off, and I went and I did Hair because some of my friends were in it, and they got me an audition, and it was a blast. And then after that, I went back to ballet, and I had always done acting. I was actually on Broadway when I was a kid in Gypsy. I was
awesome one.
I was quite young, and I just was a little tap dancing baby June. But after that, I didn't do anything on Broadway until Hair.
Yeah.
And then after that, it was kind of strictly ballet. And then when I got injured from dancing, I went back to acting and started a theater company and ended up on Sopranos and doing some other stuff. So it kind of all like worked out the way it was supposed to work out.
Cheers to your grandfather for kicking all of that off. That must have been a really special relationship.
Now, it was great. And I think the real reason he wanted to go is that he liked to go to New York and he liked to go to a restaurant there. And nobody else, you know, my family's very Italian American. My grandmother didn't barely want to leave the house. And like I said, a lot of the rest of the family weren't that interested in stuff, and I was. So he would take me along, and we'd go for dinner. And I think that was really the thing that he wanted to do, not so much the shows. But anyway, I'm grateful that he dragged me along, because it really made a difference in my life.
And I love that you were in Hair. That just seems like such a 60s rite of passage for like any theater actor. That's like the play that you would be in.
Yeah, it just, like I said, sort of happened by accident. And it was just, it was very, very different from anything that I'd seen before, that anyone had seen before. And it was great because it addressed all the, the social issues of the time. And, no play had really done that before. So it was really, it was an important play. And it was also just a lot of fun and wild and crazy. And I wasn't in it very long, but I was really happy that I got to do it, because, I still love it. I still love the music and listen to it all the time. And it's a really good memory.
So were you always into music as well? Like, if we went back to teenage Maureen's room and dug into your record collection, like, what albums would we find? Or were you going to concerts?
Well, before that, even when I was maybe, 7, 8 years old, my babysitter was a huge Elvis freak.
Cool.
So I became very, hooked on Elvis because of her. And I was this little tiny thing. I didn't even know who he was probably, but I loved the music. And I always listened to the radio. You know, I loved all the, you know, the Contours, Do You Love Me, and all those early soul songs and R&B songs, and of course all the pop songs. So I was very musical. I'm not a musician. I can't play an instrument, but I was very musically oriented, I guess, because of the dancing. So I was obsessed with music from when I was a kid. And then once the Beatles hit when I was 12 or 13, that was it, you know.
What so a time you, for the yeah, Beatles to hit when you are 12.
Yeah, exactly. I always said I was a little too young because I thought I would marry George Harrison, but I was too young for him at the time. But yeah, so if you went to my room, you'd see, you know, Beatles, Kinks, Searchers, Dave Clark Five, all the British Invasion bands, and that early part. And of course, I always still had the Broadway records because I always loved that. And then a little bit later on down the line, you know, it was Jimi Hendrix and Cream and, you know, the more, you know, harder rock, more psychedelic. But yeah, I listened to everything. I worked in a record store for a little bit.
Amazing.
So yeah, you know, because when I was dancing during the summers, you'd get laid off and or the schools were closed. And I worked in a record store with a couple of friends of mine. Of course, it was another really amazing time because it was nothing but fun. And I got every new record as soon as it came in. So I was
spent
in
all
heaven
your
with
wages
that.
From the record store on records.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I never got a paycheck. I don't think. I just said, okay, I'll take this Birds album and I'll take this Yardbirds album. And that's what I did. So I don't think I got paid.
I love how when we ask the question of kind of who got you into music, I think Babysitter might be a first on our podcast.
Yeah, I mean, that's the earliest I can remember. You know, I always liked to dance, and so music was just a really natural thing, and I loved rock and roll, and I think it had to have been from seeing Elvis, and she used to, you know, play her records when she babysat me. She used to bring this little tiny, you know, record player that played 45s, and she'd just play all her songs, and her friends might come over, and they would be dancing, so I learned how to do all the, you know, the dances of that time, and I used to go to this used to be called a soda fountain. That's, you know, that's how old I am. And they would have a jukebox and you could play records and we would all dance in the place. You know, it was like not a coffee shop, like a soda shop. So it was like a really, really innocent time. You know, it was just all, you know, about having fun with music and, you know, music was very poppy back then. So the songs were mostly, you know, they were lighthearted or about broken hearts, but it wasn't anything heavy.
Were you attending concerts as well?
I would say I attended concerts probably when I was in my early teens because, you know, my parents would not have let me go to New York. I lived in New Jersey. I did go to see stuff in New Jersey. I went to see the Beatles at Shea Stadium and at Forest Hills Tennis Stadium and lied to my parents and stayed out all night in front of their hotel. They thought I was staying at my friend's house. I was 12 years old on the street in New York. And because of the Beatles, you know, they used to do interviews and talk about artists that they liked, and they mentioned this guy, James Brown. And of course, I had never heard of him, but it turned out he was playing in my hometown, and he was doing the James Brown Review with all these great, you know, classic musicians. So my friends and I, again, we were like 13, 14, would go to the downtown area of our town and see the show every single day after school. It would start at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And you know, we got to meet him and he took us for a ride in his purple Cadillac.
No way.
Yeah. I mean, this is totally insane stuff that no one believes, but
you know, I was for this stuff.
I was just one of these people that was kind of always there and in a weird place at a weird time and something crazy would happen.
That's magic.
But yeah, so those were kind of, and I used to sneak into New York to go to the Mary the Kay shows. I don't know if you know who Mary the Kay is. He was a very famous DJ in the 60s. Mm. And he used to call himself the Fifth Beatle. I don't think they thought of him that way, but he used to, you know, he thought he was. And he would play all the records and they would go on his show and do interviews. And you know, he was really, really popular. And he used to do these shows where you'd see maybe 10, 15 of the most popular acts. I mean, I saw The Who and Cream and Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and the Temptations all on the same bill, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. So it was just a crazy time when that kind of stuff was happening. And it's, you know, never happened again, I don't think.
Wow. Yeah.
And I used, you know, later on, I used to go to Fillmore East and, you know, saw everybody there. And, you know, there were some great clubs in Manhattan. There was one called The Scene. that I hung out with when I was doing hair, because it was right around the corner, and that's like Jimi Hendrix hung out there, and like every musician who played in town would go to this club, and they would get up on stage and just jam. You know, I saw Jimmy with Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison on stage together, just kind of fooling around. So it was really special. Like I said, I got to be in these great places. I don't know how I ended up there, but I was lucky.
And yeah, did you know at the time that you were standing there looking up and, you know, at Janis, did you know this is really going to be something special one day and people are going to...
Oh, they were already huge stars then.
They were, yeah.
Yeah, they would just come and hang out at this club because it was a really cool place and it was a private club. It was, you know, not like Studio 54, but they kind of would only let certain people in. And so it was very private. It was very small. And these people felt very comfortable there because it wasn't like a million fans who would be in there bothering them. It was people that they, you know, the club owners thought would be cool and not, you know, drive anybody crazy. And yeah, of course, I was, you know, younger than these people, but I was not the type that was going to bother them. And so we were there and got to know all of them. You know, not Janis so much because she didn't live in New York, but Jimmy lived in New York, and you know, all the local artists we hung out with all the time. So, but they were big stars. So to see three big stars get up on this teeny tiny stage and just start playing music together was a once in a lifetime thing.
That's like my dream right there. Just like to go back in time, like in that era, like in New York. It's just, it sounds so magical.
It was fun.
Well, this is as close as you can get, Lynx, to actually going back in time and being there yourself.
Live it through the stories.
Well, the only thing is that I get to be older, you know. So, you know, that's one advantage you have. You're not as old as I am, but it's okay. I wouldn't trade it. You know, I would not have given up any of that stuff.
So dancing led you to theater, where you expanded your talents into acting and choreography and producing. What are some of your favorite theater experiences?
Oh, wow. I mean, aside from the couple of Broadway things that I did, I started my own theater company. So we did a ton of plays. And you know, I have another theater company now with Vincent Pastor, who was on Sopranos. We started one together. But years ago, I had my own company with some other actors. And we just did plays that we liked. So I got to do all the stuff that I liked. You know, I'd read a play, we'd get the rights, we'd do it. And so I can't say one was better than the other because they were all great. One theatrical experience that I had that I really loved, and it wasn't really in a theater per se, but it was at the United Nations. About 3 or 4 years ago, there's an Italian, she's a TV presenter and an author, and she's quite well known in Italy, named Serena Dandini. She wrote this amazing play. It's called Ferite a Morte, which means wounded to death. And it's about violence against women. And all of the women in the play are dead. And they are talking about how they were killed by their husbands or boyfriends. They all have been victims of violence and abuse. And she asked me, and she would do it with all-star casts and all over the world, and the United Nations invited her to do it there, and I was one of the lucky people that she asked to do it. And you know, for me, that was probably the most meaningful theatrical thing I've done, even though I've gotten to play, you know, Tennessee Williams characters, which I adore.
Me too.
You know, all my favorites. I got to play Blanche and, you know, Cat and Hutch, all those. I did get to do them. So that was my dream in acting, was to do that stuff. But I think as far as something that I'll never forget, you know, it was just so emotional, you
really
know,
powerful.
To have, you know, one by one, all of us go up there and deliver a monologue of someone who had been killed and was speaking from beyond. So, you know, I'm going to say that's my favorite thing.
And it's amazing because that's actually on YouTube. I got to watch you do that, and it was so powerful. So if anyone's listening and wants to check that out, definitely do that, because it was really amazing.
Yeah, I think the whole thing is on there. I haven't watched the entire thing, but it was, you know, I got to sit there and witness it all because we were all on stage together, and everyone was great. There were and they didn't use just actresses. They used people that, you know, one woman was an author, Amanda Palmer, the performance artist, she did it. A lot of interesting women, which was really cool. Abigail Disney, who's a film director and producer, and Nona Hendrix did it, which was really cool because I know Hendrix, Nona Hendrix for years, and she's fantastic. So it was a really interesting group of women to hang out with because they weren't all actors, they weren't all musicians, they were from every area of the arts and politics, and it was just a cool experience.
Well, interesting groups of women is right up our alley, right on the top of our interest list.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really love working with women, and I really hate when, you know, people think that women are competitive with each other, because I think you find the right group and there's nothing like it. You know, it's just, you know, it's great to be supported by women. And, you know, in our theater company now, it's mostly men, and I'm always really grateful to get to work with the women.
Cool. And yeah, so you've had like so many successful moments in your career, and you also have one of the most successful marriages that I can think of. You're hitting 36 years, is that right?
We were married in 1982, yeah.
Oh,
and
amazing.
We're together for a few years before that. So we just did 35 on this past New Year's Eve. Yeah, so
wow.
That's when we got married.
Would you be okay sharing the story of how you and Stephen met?
Sure. We kind of met really briefly. A friend of mine was on a softball team with Bruce and Stephen and a lot of the E Street members in New Jersey. And he said to me, oh, you know, you've got to meet these guys. They're really great. And I was like, you know, I don't really care about sports. I don't want to see any softball game. And he kind of dragged me to New Jersey. And so I went to this game and I met the guys then, and it was, you know, it was fine. They were nice, but nothing really, you know, came of it after that. And then when Bruce did that 10 days at the Bottom Line, I don't know if you know about this, it was a while ago, it was 1975. It's when he was on the cover of Time and Newsweek, and all of a sudden he became, you know, everyone thought an overnight star, but he had, of course, been working for many years and had a couple of records out already. But it was when Born to Run came out. They did a 10-night run of shows at a club called The Bottom Line. So, again, my friend said, you have to come to the show. And for some reason, I went. I guess it was destiny. And that's where I kind of really, you know, got to talk to Stephen and meet him, you know, in a more private way. But we didn't start going out until maybe 2 years later, because I was going out with somebody else then. And it just, you know, things just... It wasn't the right time, but then a couple of years later, he looked me up again, and then we started going out.
Oh, he did he?
yeah. Right. My friend told me that he kept track of things and kept saying to him, like, is she still with that guy? And as soon as he found out I wasn't, then he called me.
Good, he knew what he wanted.
Yeah, there was no, you know, Facebook, Twitter, or any of that stuff, so he had to ask somebody. There was no way he could track me down any other way.
Amazing. I've heard that the two of you had the most rock and roll wedding ever. It was
pretty crazy. Yeah. Well, first of all, Little Richard was the minister, so it doesn't get any more rock and roll. I don't need to say anything else
right?
after that.
That
so
is
he
like
performed
that.
The ceremony. It was Stephen's idea, and he tracked him down, and he was, you know, he was very happy to do it, and it was as surreal and bizarre as you can possibly imagine. And the E Street Band did a full show at the reception. A lot of Percy Sledge sang
When
a
Man
Loves
a Woman.
Yeah. When we walked out, I think. When we walked out. And we had a lot of, you know, a lot of Stephen's favorite blues artists playing there. We got married in this place called Harkness House, which is a beautiful townhouse in New York in the Upper East Side. And it's actually, there was a woman who was a patron of the arts, Rebecca Harkness. She donated this building to a ballet company. And so it was this very beautiful building with, you know, chandeliers all over the place and very fancy. And they used to rent it out. So we used it for the wedding. And it was three floors and we had music on every floor. And I don't remember most of it, and it wasn't because I was drunk or high or anything. It was just completely weird. So, but everybody tells me they had a really good time.
I bet. What a party!
Yeah,
Yeah, it was really, you know, I wish I were there, you know, that's what I always say. I wish I could, you know, I see pictures from it, and someone did video the whole thing, and I've got to get hold of this again, because I did have a copy, and I don't know what happened to it, but
yeah, you should track that down. I
try to get this out one of these days. I know. I mean, I know who did it, so I think I can get it.
Nice. Well, you've got to live one of my sort of ultimate rock and roll dreams of getting up on stage and dancing with Brewster and Dancing in the Dark, and I'm sure you've probably got to do that multiple times. I was curious.
Twice, and just fairly recently, yeah.
That's like the dream right there. Well, you tell Bruce if he's ever looking for two dancing partners coming to Toronto.
I'm sure he would love it.
We're also curious, do you have like any other, you know, memorable rock and roll moments that you look back on and are just like, wow, that was amazing?
Oh my God, there's so many of them.
Yeah,
because
I was going to say, I have a feeling she's got a couple.
I feel like I got, you know, to see all of the people that I really loved and admired and, you know, got to be friends with some of them. And I mean, I used to hang out with Jimi Hendrix, and I've been clothing shopping with him. And I used to date his drummer. I would be in the studio. So I used to be in the studio with them. And, you know, when I was there at the night Electric Lady Studios opened, and I used to, you know, because the guy was my boyfriend at the time, I used to go to the studio and hang out. And so I got to, you know, that was probably the most amazing thing for me to watch these guys working. And then after Jimmy passed away, which wasn't long after the studio opened, they mixed the records that he had recorded. So I got to sit in on a lot of those sessions. And that was really great. And while I was there, Stevie Wonder came in one night and he sang my Cherie Amour to me and had me sit at the piano next to him. It was the first time he was going to record it. So, I mean, crazy stuff. Like, I can't even remember, you know, half of the stories. But, you know, a lot of people always say to me, you should write a book. But I may one day. I've been keeping a list of a lot of these moments and maybe going to write some essays about it, just stories, not like a book, but
that was 100% on our list of questions. And it was pretty much like, when is this memoir coming out? Because,
well, see, I don't think I can do that because I don't think I'm important enough to write a book and that, you know, no one would care. But that's what. But I thought I could just write the stories, you know, because I don't think anybody cares about, you know, I was born here and I grew up here and I did this and that. I don't think people are really that interested unless you're really a celebrity. But I think the stories are fun and they're interesting. So that I am, you know, I've got a little list that I keep of all the stories that I want to write.
Well, our podcast is dedicated to telling the stories of women like you. I mean, there is no one who is just like you, but there are people interested and there's a whole niche. And so your upbringing, that's why we started with tell us about Little Maureen, because people want to know how did she become that go-getter and how did this lead to that? And these little stories are people just, and like us, we eat them like cookies. Love them.
Oh yeah. Well, someday we'll sit down and have tea, and I'll tell you a lot of the other ones. And I also felt that I could never write a book and, you know, give secrets away about people. Like I would never tell anything that was really personal.
Of course.
And I know to do that kind of book, you kind of have to do it. Like I'm not going to write a book and say, oh yes, you know, Mitch Mitchell was my boyfriend and he did this to me and he, you know, and we had a fight. You know, that kind of stuff doesn't really appeal to me. And I, you know, it's not the way I would like to present myself or present the other people. So if I do it, it would just be something that's fun.
Yeah.
Like
a
this
collection
fun
of
story.
Stories.
Yeah. Like this fun thing happened to me. Like I was, you know, at Woodstock, you know, when Jimi Hendrix played the Star Spangled Banner, you know, like that kind of stuff, just stories. And like John Lennon was my neighbor for many years. So that's one of my things that I have on my list. So there's, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, and you keep what you
but,
want
but it's
keep
nothing,
to
nothing
yourself.
Nothing really terribly personal or horrible. Yeah. I don't think there's a reason for doing that.
And we,
for me,
we came
anyway.
Into.
I enjoy it when I read other people's, but I just personally don't I'm a Scorpio. I keep a lot of things in, so I don't think that it's right for me.
My roommate's a Scorpio. Yeah, they do. And Lynx and I had a similar
I'm
attitude.
Sorry to hear for you.
It works. I'm an Aquarius, so...
No, we're not easy. That's why Sybil Maureen was a very difficult little girl.
But Lynx and I had a similar attitude when we came into the podcast. I remember being a guest on somebody else's episode, and they were trying to get me to dish the dirt, I would say. And I was like, yes, okay. Even though, you know, I have a podcast and we talk about, you know, women in music and we talk about muses and we talk about wives and girlfriends and sometimes they share certain things, you know, we're not really comfortable with that, like kind of telling the personal and intimate,
sort of yeah.
you know, tell all accounts. You know, we yeah. like to, we respect, we can respect privacy, we can respect intimate relationships, and sometimes people put things like that in order to, like, thinking that that is what's gonna sell, but I think that that's not always necessarily the case. You can keep
not
your stuff
always.
To yourself, and you can also present this also, like, these wonderful and amazing stories, and it doesn't have to be... Yeah.
No, I agree. And I think a lot of it is reality TV. You know, we're used to seeing every single thing people do aside from going to the bathroom. And I'm sure that's been, you know, shown somewhere. So, and I think that that's what people expect now. They don't just want to hear, you know, oh, I met Paul McCartney or whatever. They want to hear like, oh, well, you know, what did he say to you and what did he eat? And, you know, and I just think that's personal stuff. You know, I mean, if that person doesn't want to put it out there, I'm not going to put it out there. If they want to, fine, but I'm not going to be the one to do it.
That's a good way to, yeah, just whatever you know, you're comfortable with. I feel like that's the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So speaking of television, many know you from your time on The Sopranos. We played Sylvia's wife, Gabriella. What was your experience like working on the show?
It was interesting because up until then, I had only done live performance. You know, I did dance and theater, and that was it. I never did TV. And, you know, I had a lot of acting training, and I studied with some really, really great people. So, you know, I was prepared for the acting part, but I was not prepared for the whole technical part. You know, I always loved the experience of just going out on stage and kind of telling a story from start to finish, and then you're done, and then you can go back and do it again the next night, maybe a different way. And in TV, I felt it very restrictive. You know, I know people say you're crazy because theater is more restrictive because you only have that one shot to do it, and in TV, they can do take after take after take. But I found it really restrictive. You know, I didn't like having the cameras in my face. I just didn't like that there was no rehearsal. And of course, it was, you know, the best show on earth to be involved in because it was so beautifully written and the actors were great. And, you know, we really were a family. Everybody was great. So in that sense, it was a really great experience. And I was really lucky to be there. I mean, for your first TV show to end up on that one, you know, it's all downhill from there. But for me, it was a weird experience. It kind of was a shock to my body. And I think it took me years before I got used to it. And I don't feel like I did my best work on it because I think I was, I always felt uncomfortable. So if I could go back and do it over again, you know, well, I'd probably do it the same way, but you would think that maybe I learned something. But again, it was, it's something that, you know, was very, very, very big for me. Very, very important. Still very good friends with people I worked on the show with. I mean, some of my best friends are some of those actors and some are in my theater company. So, you know, some of us have really stayed very close.
Yeah, you mentioned you and Vincent Pastore created, is it the Renegade Nation Theater?
It's called Renegade Theater NYC.
How's that new role for you? And are you guys going to be producing more in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing things for the last several years. We usually, you know, just work in New York at local theaters. We do play readings, we do plays, we do scene nights, we do one act nights. So we do a variety of really really fun, different things. We recently did a stage reading of a play called Lovers and Other Strangers, which is from the 70s, and we're going to do a full production of that. So we're working on that. Vinny has an acting class down at HB Studios, and I sort of co-teach it with him. So we have a blast doing that because we're working with, you know, beginner actors or actors that are a little more experienced. And so the teaching thing, I think, is really is something I really, really have gotten to love. And it was something I've taught acting to ballet dancers before, which I loved. And this is a whole different thing. But the teaching thing is really a lot of fun for me.
Oh, yeah.
And we have a great time together. And we have a great, great theater company. I mean, I think some of the best actors in New York. And again, we're like a family. It's, you know, no drama, no fighting. We not only dramas on stage. And it's great. You know, I feel really lucky.
That's wonderful. I bet you're an amazing teacher. And speaking of which, one of our favorite things about you is how much time and effort you put into the causes that you care about. So you're really working nonstop on some incredible projects. So we were wondering if we could talk about the Rock and Roll Forever Foundation and Teach Rock.
Oh, of course. I mean, the thing is, I'm not really that actively involved in it. It's really Steven's foundation, and he has a whole really, really great team who handle all that stuff. You know, of course I've, you know, been involved in, you know, fundraising events and things like that. But, you know, of course I supported it, you know, immensely. It's, you know, they've written a rock and roll curriculum, a history of rock, and it's been introduced in many, many schools, and there are many more coming on board. It's really the history of rock, and it combines music, but also, what was going on in the world at the time. So it'll take you back to a place and a time and what music was important then, but it also gives kids the history of what was going on in the world, like, let's say, the 60s, the civil rights movement, and then it will address songs that were associated with that. So it really gives kids a history lesson as well as a music lesson. And Stephen's upcoming tour is going to be associated with the foundation, and he's giving out free tickets to teachers. And they'll come and do a seminar with him and his band before they do the show. And then they see the show that evening, because his show is really, it really is kind of a history of rock and roll, because he has many different genres of music in it. So it's going to be great. I think it's going to be fun to have all those teachers there.
That's really, really amazing. And we were talking earlier too, as well, Lynx and I, with somebody else about the music curriculum in the United States, because I'm an elementary school teacher in Canada, and
oh,
I didn't.
You are.
Yeah, yeah. Right from like the grades primary up to grade six, so like 6 years old to about 12 years old.
Wow, that's impressive. That I don't know. I mean, I've taught little kids ballet, and it's very difficult.
No way. I love
admire
it.
You for your patience. Yes.
And it certainly has its challenges, as, you know, all education systems do. But
absolutely,
I really
yeah.
love that it's making the learning meaningful, you know, in that sense, and just really developing the importance of the arts as well as the science and technology, and just having this whole holistic education. But
absolutely, because, you know, the arts are not in school anymore. I was lucky enough to go to an arts and music high school, you know, a high school performing arts. And but, you know, that still exists. But in regular schools now, they've taken out
that
a lot of that stuff. I mean, I had music class in elementary school, and I had art class. That doesn't exist anymore.
That breaks
and
my heart.
It's heartbreaking. I mean, I don't know how it is in Canada. I don't know if the same sort of thing is going on, but we really, you know, the arts are the first classes that they will cut from any school curriculum. So it's really sad, because I think, you know, whether or not, you know, a kid wants to be an artist, you know, having that in their life makes such a difference. It informs everything that they do.
It does. And it's not like that in Canada. We don't have a perfect education system, but we certainly have our students with a music teacher a couple times a week. And the music teachers are all so qualified. And like, we have rooms of musical instruments.
Oh, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. There was one time before I got like a permanent contract that I was substitute teaching, and I was doing drama. drama, but it was in the music room, and I didn't know what we were doing, and the kids weren't really listening to anything about the drama, so I just pointed to the piano, and I said, does anybody know how to play?
That's the best thing, that spontaneous thing that always brings out the best in everybody.
One of the kids
It's really important because that's great. I mean, a couple of the other organizations that we work with there's one called Little Kids Rock, which gives musical instruments to kids in underprivileged areas. So we go to schools and we'll deliver, 50 guitars or keyboards or something to kids that, couldn't afford them, couldn't afford lessons, and then they train the teachers to teach the kids how to play them. And it makes such a, really, brings tears to your eyes when you see these kids, first of all, getting a guitar for the first time in their life and thinking like, what am I going to do with this? And then you go back 3 months later and they've learned how to play some stuff and they're starting to write their own songs, things that they never thought they would ever do in their lives. So it's really, it's very, very rewarding to see that. And another group we work with is called Rocket. They are based in New Jersey and they work mostly at the Count Basie Theater where we're on the board. They have just a great it's really a rock and roll program for kids. And these kids are amazing. They're great singers and they, they play every instrument and it's just because somebody cared enough to start this program. Mm-hmm. So I really, really support them.
And for us who are out of school now, Teach Rock, you can do online courses, which are awesome.
Yes. Yes, so. teachrock.org. You can find everything online that you want to find. And it's ongoing. I mean, they're still doing, they're updating. They're getting into more contemporary music. Because what they do a lot is they'll go into school and they'll have the teacher. When they train the teachers, they tell them, ask the kids, what are you listening to now? Like, what's your phone now or your iPod or whatever, however you're listening? And they'll tell them. And then they say, okay, well, do you want to know where that came from? And then they will trace the roots back. So maybe, if they're listening to hip hop, they're going to go back to people like Gil Scott Heron, and they're going to go back to blues. And, so they always try to find a way to trace the music back to its roots and its history and show them what was happening and how this developed. So it's just really, it's very stimulating for their minds as well as, that it's fun.
At the end of every school year, it doesn't matter what grade the kids were in, and especially back when people were listening to CDs more, I would make the kids in my class, now it's just like a playlist on Spotify that I do for them, but I make them a playlist of everything that we listened to in our classroom throughout the year, and I came, it's really one of the biggest unifiers of the entire class to make us feel like we're a community and that we have this thing that we share, whether it
be... Absolutely, now that's a cool teacher, I wish I had that instead of some of the nuns that taught me.
So speaking of, America right now, we've noticed that you are active on social media and you use that platform to sort of use your voice against issues that are in America right now.
Yeah. How are you finding, I guess, balance in terms of keeping your mental health in check and just trying to stay in that light, just to go towards the light, because it seems pretty heavy.
It's really hard. I mean, Trump was elected on my birthday and, we were having a birthday party and, got the news then. So that already put a huge downer on my life. But, I think, I will post. I'm only on Twitter. That's the only social media I do. That's all I can handle, I think. I will post things about Trump and, the government and some of the awful things, the Republicans are doing to our country. I will, but I can't make it a 24-hour thing because it really depletes my spirit to do it. So I sort of made a decision that I will talk about, that kind of stuff very little. I will talk about animal rights much more because that's something that's really close to my heart. And it's nothing to do with politics. There are a lot of things that I will I feel strongly about, we'll post about. But I think that if I'm on social media, it's really, I don't see it as a platform for me to air my politics. You know, I'll say something, but I'm not going to get into arguments with people and, you know, be talking about Trump all day long. I just think it's very tiresome. It's very boring. And I think it's depressing. So I try to talk about music, you know, like, oh, I saw this great new band, or I saw this great Broadway show. And I think people may think that's superficial, but I'd rather bring something positive.
Absolutely. You need the balance.
There, you know, and, you know, I went on Twitter for fun because my friends were on it and we just were fooling around. And now it's become very serious and very politically correct, you know, which I don't like. You know, I don't believe in censorship. And it's just, you know, you can't say anything without 50 crazies attacking you. So I really pick and choose what I'm going to say. I have to be really, really pissed off to say something. You know, look, I support these kids in Florida who started this, you know, March for Our Lives movement. And I just think they're incredible. We got to meet two of them a few weeks ago, and I was just so impressed. But I didn't go on and talk about it. Because everybody's talking about it. You know, it's out there. What they're doing is great. I support them 100% and hope to be able to go to the march, which is March 24th. But I don't want to dwell on that stuff. You know, I say what I have to say. Here's how I feel about it. And I'm not going to complain. You know, that's what people are complaining all the time, which drives me crazy. You know, I don't mind people stating their views and what they think and how horrified they are. But then, you know, to be complaining every day, you know, it doesn't get you anywhere. You have to go and try to make the change, mm-hmm. you know, register to vote. Like everybody says, go and vote these people out, you know, be a more positive force in the world, help other people. And I think that, you know, the one thing I think is happening because of all this terrible stuff that's happening in our country is I feel like I see people being nicer to each other in a way and supporting each other. I don't know. It's just something that I feel is in the air. I felt it after 9/11 happened here, after, you know, the horrible attack we had in New York. People were nicer to each other. And I almost feel like it's kind of happening now because we're all sort of in this together. Mm-hmm. And so I think if any positive thing is to come of it, is that I think that we are going to make a change happen because we're so unhappy with what's going on now. It's like what happened in the 60s. You know, I was lucky to have been around then. We did change things.
That's, you know, interesting. Does it feels sort of the same as it did then, huh?
It does. I mean, I think there are a lot more complex things going on now. But, you know, and a lot of the issues are still the same, which is horrible. I mean, you know, racism, bigotry, it was terrible back then. It's terrible now. Mm-hmm. And we tried to make some changes. And I mean, look, you know, civil rights movement did accomplish so much. But, you know, we're not totally there yet. Yeah. But at least we fought for it. You know, we went to the streets and we went to protests and we protested against the war and, you know, all the other, you know, bad stuff that was happening then. And we did make things happen. Mm-hmm. And I that's why I love seeing what these kids are doing now, because I think that they're going to make things happen.
I agree.
I hope. I think we all have to support them.
Yeah. And I think just, you know, having this conversation about children in schools, like, it's just a common theme that comes up like a lot. And I am hopeful for our future. And in the meantime, we just have to all keep leading by example and being that change. And, you know, I can walk into a classroom and I can say this and this and this. But the biggest thing is they're watching how you're acting and how you treat other people and how you deal with conflict and how you, you know, if I want to try and help raise a generation of peaceful and loving and forgiving people that can get along with each other, then we need to model it every day in our own lives as well.
Exactly. It's like they said, people won't remember what you said. They won't remember what you did, but they will remember how you made them feel and how you treated them.
Exactly.
So I think that, you know, we have to treat people, you know, sounds cliche, how we want to be treated. And I think that would solve many, many problems.
So we have something in common. Apparently you're also a podcaster.
Yes. Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. This is a relatively new thing, which is also something I would never, ever have done. But there was a guy named Josh Accardo. He's a really brilliant comedian and actor. He had his own podcast, and he asked me, he asked to interview me. I think he's a big, well, I know he's a big Sopranos fan, and I think that's why he wanted to interview me, and he did, and we just really hit it off, and you know, we found that we had so much in common, even though he's like 20-something, 30 years younger than me, and he got this idea of doing a radio show or a podcast called Generation Gap, and we, so we talk about things that, you know, from his point of view, from my point of view, and surprisingly, we feel the same way about a lot of stuff. We thought it was going to be a lot of conflict. Well, you know, this is how I think this should be, and we kind of, he's sort of you know, an older soul maybe, and but we do touch on a lot of things that, you know, affects millennials and my generation, and we'll do fun things like we'll take the top 10 songs from, let's say, 1969, and we'll put them up against the top 10 songs this week.
You know,
and we talk about it, and of course I, you know, really have to restrain myself, but but that's the fun of it. And we take, you know, it's a lot of pop culture stuff. It's, you know, a lot of nonsense, but also I think we do have some serious conversations. But we, you know, we pick fun stories and then more serious thing. We like to talk about, you know, the arts, of course, and we discuss movies, books, music, and a lot of music, I think.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure what to expect when I found out that you had one. And then I went and saw just what the descriptions were of the titles of the podcasts and what you were going to be discussing that episode. And I smiled, being like,
yeah, and
this
it all kinds
gonna
of
be
it,
good.
This no matter
funny.
What it says in the description, it always goes off into something else. And it's just funny. We just really, you know, work well together. I'm really shy. And I don't like to put myself out there. I don't like to promote myself or anything I do. And so he's really kind of, you know, brought that kind of fun, you know, aspect in me out, you know, with this show. You know, I can't believe that I'm talking about some of the things I'm talking about. We play like role playing. We, you know, like next show, I think I'm playing Kim Kardashian. God knows what that's going to be like. But we do like just silly things like that, you know, and then we talk about serious things. We talk about, you know, the women's movement quite a lot and all the, you know, stuff that's been happening with that, which is enormous. So I think we have a pretty good balance, and it's fun.
That's so great. And you have a really beautiful voice. So like I know you said maybe singing, but this like speaking voice, it's
great. Really lovely.
Oh, really? Because I don't see it at all. I cannot listen. I can't even watch myself on TV or listen to myself. So that's very nice that you say that.
No, the listening bit is really nice. So it's really important to be playful and to also talk about the things that are important. And I think this whole generation gap thing, I think just with you speaking to us and us being so interested in you and him as well, like I think this is something that's really important to a lot of people right now, is all of us having these conversations and sometimes keeping it really light because you have to, but then also getting into some serious conversation because we have to. So
yeah, that's kind of what we do. And you know, I learn stuff from him, you know, and he learns things from me. And it's, I think that when you do talk, you realize that people aren't all that different, you know, no matter how old they are, or how young they are, they're very basic traits that we all have and basic interests and things we care about. And it's just, you know, it's basically the technology, you know, I have to give my phone to my niece if I have to do anything. You know, but, and he laughs at me about that stuff, and I laugh at him about the stuff that he does with all his gadgets and devices, and, you know, it's all fun. I mean, it's always been generation gap, you know. I think it's probably less now, you know, than what we had with our parents, because they were really, I think, way more conservative, and they, you know, there just was not that kind of freedom. I think that my generation was probably the first generation that really had freedom. Had our own music, our own clothing, and things that we were interested in, and you know, sexual liberation came at that time. And so I think, you know, I was lucky to grow up then. But my parents, you know, were not that at all. They just did whatever their parents did or wanted them to do. So we kind of changed things in that way too.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. Well, I think that's a wonderful place to just say thank you for sharing all of this wonderful stuff with us and opening up about yourself and telling us some great stories that we had no idea that we absolutely love to hear about. Yeah. We really appreciate it, and you're amazing.
Oh, does it have to end now? I'm having such a good time.
No, it doesn't have to end. Okay, so then we have one more
question. But really, it's been really... Okay, okay.
So just ending on this idea of, like, what brings you joy? What is, like, your ideal day? What just brings you absolute joy?
My ideal day?
Yeah.
Is that what you said? The sound kind of broke up for a sec. My ideal day is spending time with my dog, walking around Greenwich Village, taking a ballet class, listening to music, watching The Crown on TV or mm-hmm. Mad Men. Nice. Yeah, just really, you know, and also, you know, like I said, I've started to really grow to love teaching people. So, you know, I love working with young artists. So I would say that would probably be the... You know, one of the best parts of my day. That and my dog. My dog is always the best.
What kind of dog?
And of course, I'm not leaving my husband out here because, of course, I think that's understood. But I'm talking about days. I don't see him that much. He's always out working. So I'm talking about a day on my own. I have a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. Aww. She's a little princess. She's a beauty, and she was a gift to me from actually a musician friend of mine. You know, best gift I've ever gotten in my life.
Yeah, they are like the best therapy. They give like so much love. Having an animal around is the best thing anyone could have.
Oh yeah, just it kind of makes you forget a lot of things. You know, I come into the house sometimes really stressed, and I see that little face, and I'm like, you know, who cares about anything else? So yeah, they do. I mean, they've been proven to have really, you know, serious health benefits for people. And, you know, aside from that, just the psychological aspect, and they give you love. They don't really expect anything from you. It's like, we should all be like them.
Except
you know,
some,
they're more highly evolved than we are, you know?
Yeah. We're both animal lovers. And so, yeah, I think
your
day that you said there sounds beautiful. For me, I would just add in probably something sweet, like a chocolate cake or something. And then...
Yes.
And then I can go to
definitely.
Bed happy.
Definitely. I wasn't thinking about the food part of it, but yeah, that it would definitely be some kind of sweets.
I think Shanti's hungry.
Me too. I've always been a huge chocolate addict, and then my doctor told me I had to stop eating it because it was bothering my stomach. So I started sneaking it back again, and you know, so far so good.
So I started seeing a new doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I got rid of the doctor, but I was eating it every day, you know, and my doctor was like, you know, that's one of the reasons why you have a, you know, sensitive stomach. It's not really good for you. So, but anyway, I think it is good for me. So I'm back on it again. I'm back off the wagon, as they say, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Maureen, this has been like such a joy for us. This is like our perfect day.
Oh, yep.
Oh, that's so sweet. It's so lovely to talk to you. And, you know, anytime you want to do it again, want to hear other stories, I would love to talk to you guys.
Absolutely.
You guys are great.
Oh, amazing.
Music to our ears. Yes.
Oh, fantastic. And I'm coming up to your town in a couple of weeks. So next week, actually, Sunday. So
if you have maybe any time to hang.
Yeah, that would be great. I will get in touch if I do. I don't know how crazy it's going to be once I get there, but I think there should be some time. Maybe we can have a tea and some chocolate or something and talk about music.
Amazing.
Oh, that would be so wonderful. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah,
We'll be in touch soon.
Absolutely.
And we'll
peace and love.
Peace, love, rock
and
roll.
Chocolate.
Yes. Yeah. Chocolate.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.